Well, good morning, friends. You know, it's only 4 days until Thanksgiving, but I don't know about you, but it seems to me this year a little bit harder than usual to give thanks. Here we are in the midst of a global pandemic. Millions have become sick, many seriously. 250,000 of our fellow citizens have died. And even those of us who have remained healthy have been stuck at home for months. Many businesses have closed, others are struggling. Millions of Americans have lost their jobs. And aside from the pandemic, there's plenty of other horrible news to dampen our enthusiasm. On a weekly basis, black men and women in this country have died needlessly at the hands of the police. The U.S. has been roiled by racial tension. There have been horrible wildfires around the world. In Australia, 1 billion animals have died, and the fires are still raging in the western U.S. And on top of all that, we just came through a terribly contentious election in which the apparent loser still hasn't conceded his loss. There's strife and conflict in our country and around the world, and now it's almost Thanksgiving. And juxtaposed to the reality that we're all experiencing are the usual sappy Hallmark images of fat and happy pilgrims sharing a feast of plenty with their generous Native American benefactors and giving thanks for the bounty of this land that they had settled. Well, easy for them to give thanks, you might say. They didn't have to contend with the past 400 years of misuse, misgovernance, mismanagement of the paradise they left us. Take a look, pilgrims, at the mess your descendants have made. We killed off most of those helpful Native Americans through war and disease. We cut down the forests. We polluted the air, the land, and the water. We even managed to change the climate so as to imperil our very existence on this planet. And now we can't even agree on who should govern us. Sorry, pilgrims, you left us a paradise, and what did we do? Well, like the old song says, we paved paradise and put up a parking lot. So what's there to be thankful about? But maybe that misrepresents things just a little bit. For one thing, let's take another look at those fat and happy pilgrims around the table at that first Thanksgiving. Because whatever troubles we may have, they had it worse. Perhaps you remember from your grade school history that the pilgrims landed on Cape Cod in the summer of 1620 and then settled for the winter across the bay at Plymouth Rock. In fact, it was the 20th of November, 1620, exactly 4 centuries from last Friday, when they arrived at Plymouth Rock. Those pilgrims were members of an English religious sect fleeing persecution in their homeland. And the conditions they were fleeing were pretty harsh. The first governor of Plymouth Colony, William Bradford, described life in England for them as follows, quote, "They could not long continue in any peaceable condition, but were hunted and persecuted on every side. So their former afflictions were as flea bitings in comparison with those that now came upon them. Some were taken and clapped up in prison. Others had their houses beset and watched night and day and hardly escaped the hands of their persecutors," unquote. And so they fled, first to Holland, where they had heard there was freedom of religion. But after a few years of relative freedom there, and fearing the assimilation of their youth into the Dutch culture and religion, they fled to America in 1620. But when their little ship Mayflower reached Cape Cod, the 100 men, women, and children on board were bitterly disappointed to discover that they had landed some 300 miles north of their original destination, which was Virginia, a much more hospitable place. And after a few weeks of barely scratching out a living on an exposed spit of land near Provincetown, the settlers sailed across the bay to Plymouth, and a more heavily forested and protected mainland. where they hope to find food and shelter for the coming winter. But those next few months were a nightmare. There was very little to eat. They survived on small portions of salt beef and hardtack. Many of them developed scurvy because there were no fruit or vegetables available. Almost everyone fell sick, and fully half of the expedition died cold and horrible deaths that winter. William Bradford again describes it this way. So they died, sometimes two or three a day, and of 100 and odd persons, scarce 50 remained. And of these, in the time of most distress, there was but 6 or 7 sound persons who, to the great commendation be it spoken, spared no pains, night or day, but with abundance of toil and hazard to their own health, fetched them wood, made them fires, dressed their meat, washed their loathsome clothes, clothed and unclothed them. In a word, did all the homely and necessary offices for them which dainty and queasy stomachs cannot endure to be here named, unquote. Without the help of the local Wampanoag Indians, who generously shared food with the pilgrims that winter and showed them how to plant the native corn the following spring, the colony almost certainly would have been wiped out by starvation and disease. And by the way, it's something of a miracle in itself that the Indians were even willing to help these newcomers. One named Squanto was extremely helpful because he spoke English and served as a translator for the group. But Squanto only spoke English because he had earlier been abducted by the British, who tried to sell him into slavery to the Spanish. But in spite of that, he shared his skills and knowledge with the colonists, knowledge that proved invaluable to their survival. And luckily for the 50 or so remaining newcomers, that first summer was a generous one. The harvest was so good that by late November, as Bradford puts it, they were safely gathered in ere the winter storms began. But now comes the spiritually amazing part of this story. In spite of all their hardship and the horror that they had endured, in spite of their grief over having lost half of their company, their family members and friends, and in spite of the terrible suffering each had individually endured, that little band of survivors decided to mark their good fortune and give thanks to God and to creation. And they mounted a 3-day celebration of food and festivities for themselves and the Native Americans who had helped them so generously. And of course, at this time of year, we're surrounded by what we take to be images of that first Thanksgiving. We stuff ourselves with turkey and yams, supposing that we're doing as the pilgrims did 4 centuries ago. But it just isn't so. In truth, the pilgrims seated at that first Thanksgiving table were haggard survivors, exhausted men and women, thin and weak, wearing little more than rags. And yes, they were grateful to have survived, but those happy feelings must have been tempered by the grief over their terrible personal loss and by their fears of the uncertainties of the upcoming winter. To my mind, the real miracle of that first Thanksgiving is that they gave thanks at all in the midst of all of that terrible hardship and sorrow. Who could have blamed them if instead, as the first anniversary of their arrival in America approached, they had decided instead to hold a service of mourning for their dead and withdrawn into their own sadness and fear in the gathering autumn darkness? Yet somehow they chose gratitude over bitterness, generosity over greed, thanksgiving over self-pity. As the philosopher Soren Kierkegaard once observed, it takes real courage to grieve, but it takes religious courage to rejoice. Which brings us to today's reading from Paul's letter to the Corinthians. Paul, too, starts by giving thanks. Thanks for the people of Corinth and the gifts that God has bestowed on them. And those gifts are many. The Corinthians are a remarkable group of people, diverse and dedicated, bright, talented, involved, invested in the gospel. Paul says that they are enriched in every way and not lacking in any spiritual gift. These are enthusiastic believers and experiencing the Spirit of God in their lives. But indeed, that seems to be the source of some of the problems that Paul is addressing in his letter. Yes, the Corinthians are feeling the presence of God in their lives, but they're having trouble translating that experience into practical rules for living in Christian community day to day. And so there's been squabbling and disagreements among them. Certain members of the community have been acting out in ways that others find inappropriate. And questions have arisen. How are they to conduct themselves? How are they to worship? How are they to treat others among them who have done things of which they disapprove? And so a delegation has written to Paul asking for his advice. But even that causes problems, because these smart and gifted people can't even seem to agree on who should give them advice. Is it Paul, the apostle who founded their church? Is it Paul's colleague Apollos, who has preached in the community? Is it the apostle Peter, who has personal experience of the Lord? Or do they even need guidance from anyone? Some of them seem to be claiming that they have a direct pipeline to the risen Christ. And so Paul writes, quote, "It's been reliably reported to me that there are quarrels among you. Some of you are saying, 'I belong to Paul,' or 'I belong to Apollos,' or 'I belong to Cephas,' or 'I belong to Christ,'" unquote. You know, you might think from reading some descriptions of the early Christian communities, such as those found in the Acts of the Apostles, that the early Christians all lived in perfect harmony, sharing their goods equally, that they never had any strife or disagreement. But a little bit like those grade school pageants with the fat and happy pilgrims at that first Thanksgiving, it just wasn't so. And that's what our passage from 1 Corinthians is telling us. Like us, those first Christians were human beings with all the flaws and failings of human beings. They came from diverse religious and theological backgrounds. They had differing perspectives and beliefs. It would be surprising if they didn't disagree. As with most human communities, particularly religious communities, the Corinthians contained strong qualities and strongly held beliefs that sometimes clashed in a heady mix of divisiveness and rivalry. In fact, the issues had become so heated that some of the Corinthians had even turned to pagan courts to settle their disagreements. And Paul is really disturbed by this. He writes, quote, "I say this to your shame. Can it be that there's no one wise enough among you to decide between one believer and another? But a believer goes to court against a believer, and before unbelievers at that. In fact, to have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you," unquote. So what's Paul's point? Well, it's just this. Each of the factions is trying to win the day, trying to get the better of the others. Each side has its argument. Each side had points in its favor. But in the midst of all of this wrangling, it's the community that is suffering. Does that sound like something that might be going on in our right now? But Paul is not interested in judging a debate or in supporting one side over another. He's concerned with less with who's right and about how they'll live together. The scripture scholar Luke Timothy Johnson describes it this way. Paul much prefers ambiguity of life together than a community separated into mutually opposing and theoretically opposing correct factions, unquote. Another way to say that is this. Paul is more concerned that they have integrity as a Christian community, that they be together, than that any group gets their way all the time about the issues that divide them. Does any of that sound familiar? Well, it should, because it's a lot like what goes on in our country, our fellowship, and even our individual churches all the time. Look, for example, at the 50-plus year history of MCC churches, and you'll find a lot of disagreement and division, a lot of strong personalities butting heads about how things should be done and who belongs and who doesn't. And that's hardly surprising when you consider that MCC came into being as a community of folks from very different backgrounds, with different positions and different beliefs. In fact, it's almost a miracle that this denomination is still around 50 years on. But somehow, we've decided that it's better that we be together than that anyone gets their way all the time. And that's a lot more special than you might realize. Did you know, for example, that in the 1980s, the Council on Church Union of the National Council of Churches called MCC denomination, quote, the most successful ecumenical experiment in the 2,000-year history of the Christian church. The most successful ecumenical experiment in the 2,000-year history of the Christian church. Well, that's a pretty amazing claim. But what does it mean? Well, it means this. Somehow, in spite of the odds, we found a way to come together and to stay together in worship, in fellowship, and in communion, even though we don't all look alike, and even though we come from diverse backgrounds, and even though we don't all believe the same things. You hear the echo of that every Sunday at communion tables throughout our fellowship when we say, you don't have to be a member of this church or any church to partake in this celebration. That's an affirmation that there's room at God's table for all of us, no matter where we come from and no matter what we believe. It's an affirmation that the gifts of God aren't the province of any one group or denomination or community of faith. It's an affirmation that it's more important for us to be together than for any of us to get our way all the time. Now, that's not to say that MCC is a perfect institution, far from it. Why, at one MCC general conference in the 80s, a group of conservative clergy got together and drafted a fundamentalist document that they called an abstract of faith. And in the midst of the night, they took it to our founder and moderator, Reverend Troy Perry, and demanded that he require that all MCC clergy sign it or lose their clergy credentials. But the important thing was what happened next. At the conference business meeting the following morning, Reverend Perry announced that as long as he was the moderator of this denomination, there will be no God police in MCC. There will be no God police in MCC. That's just another way of saying that we don't assume the right to judge who is acceptable in God's eyes and who isn't. The job of God is taken, and you didn't get it. So what does all this have to do with Thanksgiving? Just this. In spite of how bleak things may look at any given moment, we really do have a lot to be thankful for. Because being thankful doesn't require that everything is perfect. Even in the midst of darkness, there's reason for thanks. Yes, we still have a pandemic raging around the world, but in just the last 2 weeks, we've heard about vaccines which are over 90% effective. Yes, black men and women are still dying, but millions of us have stood up and said, Black lives matter. Yes, there are wildfires still burning in the West, but the winter snows are coming. Yes, we've done terrible things to our environment, but with God's help, there's hope that we'll be able to pull things back from the brink. Yes, we have a president that won't accept his electoral loss, but our democracy will survive. And yes, we as a church still can't worship in person together, but we'll get through this. We will persevere and we will thrive. I believe that because I know the heart of this congregation. Like those pilgrims, we've had our hard times before, times when it might have seemed better to just give it up, but we're still here. And that's reason enough to give thanks for the wonderful ministry you do in this community and for the gift of being together when we can get together again, despite all the odds. Our reading from 1 Corinthians has a couple of important lessons to teach this congregation at this point in our journey of faith together. And the first is this. Just as Paul did, start by giving thanks. All that we are, all that we have, all that we ever hope to be are gifts from our gracious Creator. And there are reasons aplenty for giving thanks in this church at this and every season of the year. Like the Corinthians, the people of this congregation are incredibly gifted, dedicated, talented, deeply committed to this community of faith. And that's reason enough for give thanks. And second, give thanks in spite of whatever difficulties you have and whatever challenges confront you, confident that God will see you through. That's not to say that the process will be painless or that we won't have disagreements or dissension. But when was anything that truly mattered ever easy? Remember, Paul begins his letter with thanks for the people of Corinth, but not because he suffered any illusions about the weaknesses or the humanity of that beloved community. He gave thanks in spite of their flaws. He gave thanks not for their perfection, but for their promise. And in the same way, the pilgrims gave thanks, not because they didn't foresee the hardship and the suffering ahead. They gave thanks in spite of it. They gave thanks for the God who gave them life, for the strangers who welcomed and taught them, and for the hope that by persevering they had a chance to build a better future for those who came after them. Besides, as Governor Bradford might have said, our difficulties seem as flea bitings in comparison with those our ancestors endured. So in this season, we give thanks. Thanks for living in a free society. Thanks for being able to worship as we choose. Thanks for the gifts that God continues to bestow on this community of faith. So this week and every week, give thanks, not for perfection, but for the promise of our lives together. Happy Thanksgiving, Uprising. Amen.